Disc 4. Chapter 15. Jerusalem. In the old days he would have taken the fast road north through Ramallah, Nablus, and Jenin. Now even a man with the survival skills of Gabriel would be foolhardy to attempt such a run, without an armored car and battle escort. So he took the long way round, down the western slope of the Judean mountains toward Tel Aviv, up the coastal plain to Hadera, then northeast, through the Mount Carmel ridge, to El Megiddo, Armageddon. The valley opened before him, stretching from the Sumerian hills in the south to the slopes of the Galilee in the north, a green-brown patchwork of row crops, orchards and forest lands, planted by the earliest Jewish settlers in Mandate Palestine. He headed toward Nazareth, then east to a small farming town on the edge of the Balfour Forest, called Ramat David. It took him a few minutes to find the address. The bungalow that had been built for the Allons had been torn down and replaced by a California-style sandstone rambler with a satellite dish on the roof and an American-made minivan in the front drive. As Gabriel looked on, a soldier stepped from the front door and walked briskly across the front lawn. Gabriel's memory flashed. He saw his father making the same journey on a warm evening in June, and though he had not realized it then, it would be the last time Gabriel would ever see him alive. He looked at the house next door. It was the house where Tsiona had lived. The plastic toys littering the front lawn indicated that Tsiona, unmarried and childless, did not live there any more. Still, Israel was nothing if not an extended, quarrelsome family, and Gabriel was confident the new occupants could at least point him in the right direction. He rang the bell. The plump young woman who spoke Russian-accented Hebrew did not disappoint him. Tsiona was living up in Safed. The Russian woman had a forwarding address. Jews had been living in the center of Safed since the days of antiquity. After the expulsion from Spain in 1492, the Ottoman Turks allowed many more Jews to settle there, and the city flourished as a center of Jewish mysticism, scholarship, and art. During the War of Independence, Safed was on the verge of falling to superior Arab forces when the besieged community was reinforced by a platoon of Palmach fighters who stole into the city after making a daring night crossing from their garrison on Mount Canaan. The leader of the Palmach unit negotiated an agreement with Safed's powerful rabbis to work over Passover to reinforce the city's fortifications. His name was Ari Shamron. Tsiona's apartment was in the artist's quarter, at the top of a flight of cobblestone steps. She was an enormous woman, draped in a white caftan with wild grey hair, and so many bracelets that she clanged and clattered when she threw her arms around Gabriel's neck. She drew him inside, into a space that was both a living room and potter's studio, and sat him down on the stone terrace to watch the sunset over the Galilee. The air smelled of burning lavender oil. A plate of bread and hummus appeared, along with olives and a bottle of Golan wine. Gabriel relaxed instantly. Tsiona Levin was the closest thing to a sibling he had. She had cared for him when his mother was working or was too sick from depression to get out of bed. Some nights, he would climb out his window and steal next door into Tsiona's bed. She would caress and hold him in a way his mother never could. When his father was killed in the June War, it was Tsiona who wiped away his tears. The rhythmic, hypnotic sound of Mariv prayers floated up from a nearby synagogue. Tsiona added more lavender oil to the lamp. She talked of the Matsav, the situation, of the fighting in the territories and the terror in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, of friends lost to the Shahid and friends who had given up trying to find work in Israel and had moved to America instead. Gabriel drank his wine and watched the fiery sun sink into the Galilee. He was listening to Tsiona, but his thoughts were of his mother. It had been nearly 20, and in the intervening time he had found himself thinking of her less and less. Her face, as a young woman, was lost to him, stripped of pigment and abraded, like a canvas faded by time and exposure to corrosive elements. Only her death mask could he conjure. After the tortures of cancer, her emaciated features had settled into an expression of serenity, like a woman posing for a portrait. She seemed to welcome death. It had finally given her deliverance from the torments raging inside her memory. Had she loved him? Yes, he thought now, but she had surrounded herself with walls and battlements that he could never scale. She was prone to melancholia and violent mood swings. She did not sleep well at night. She could not show pleasure on festive occasions, and could not partake of rich food and drink. She wore a bandage always on her left arm, over the faded numbers tattooed into her skin. She referred to them as her mark of Jewish weakness, her emblem of Jewish shame. Gabriel had taken up painting to be closer to her. She soon resented this as an unwarranted intrusion on her private world. Then, when his talents matured and began to challenge hers, she begrudged his obvious gifts. Gabriel pushed her to new heights. Her pain, so visible in life, found expression in her work. Gabriel grew obsessed with the nightmarish imagery that flowed from her memory onto her canvases. He began to search for the source. In school he had learned of a place called Birkenau. He asked her about the bandage she wore habitually on her left arm, about the long-sleeved blouses she wore, even in the furnace-like heat of the Jezreel Valley. He asked what had happened to her during the war, what had happened to his grandparents. She refused at first, but finally, under his steady onslaught of questions, she relented. Her account was hurried and reluctant. Gabriel, even in youth, was able to detect the note of evasion and more than a trace of guilt. Yes, she had been in Birkenau. Her parents had been murdered there on the day they arrived. She had worked. She had survived. That was all. Gabriel, hungry for more details about his mother's experience, began to concoct all manner of scenarios to account for her survival. He, too, began to feel ashamed and guilty. Her affliction, like a hereditary disorder, was thus passed on to the next generation. The matter was never discussed again. It was as if a steel door had swung shut, as if the Holocaust had never happened. She fell into a prolonged depression and was bedridden for many days. When finally she emerged, she retreated to her studio and began to paint. She worked relentlessly, day and night. Once, Gabriel peered through the half-open door and found her sprawled on the floor, her hands stained by paint, trembling before a canvas. That canvas was the reason he had come to Safed to see Tziona. The sun was gone. It had grown cold on the terrace. Tziona drew a shawl around her shoulders and asked Gabriel if he ever intended to come home. Gabriel mumbled something about needing to work, like Tziona's friends who had moved to America. "And who are you working for these days?" He didn't rise to the challenge. "I restore old master paintings. I need to be where the paintings are, in Venice."
"Venice," she said derisively. "Venice is a museum."
She raised her wine glass toward the Galilee.
"This is real life. This is art. Enough of this restoration. You should be devoting all your time and energy to your own work."
"There's no such thing as my own work. That went out of me a long time ago. I'm one of the best art restorers in the world. That's good enough for me." Tziona threw up her hands. Her bracelets clattered like wind chimes.
"It's a lie! You're a lie! You're an artist, Gabriel. Come to Safed and find your art. Find yourself."
Her prodding was making him uncomfortable. He might have told her there was now a woman involved, but that would have opened a whole new front that Gabriel was anxious to avoid. Instead, he allowed a silence to fall between them, which was filled by the consoling sound of Mariv.
"What are you doing in Safed?"
she finally asked.
"I know you didn't come all the way up here for a lecture from your Dodda Tziona."
He asked whether Tziona still had his mother's paintings and sketches.
"Of course, Gabriel. I've been keeping them all these years, waiting for you to come and claim them."
"I'm not ready to take them off your hands yet. I just need to see them." She held a candle to his face.
"You're hiding something from me, Gabriel. And the only person in the world who can tell when you're keeping secrets. It was always that way. especially when you were a boy."
Gabriel poured himself another glass of wine and told Siona about Vienna. She pulled open the door of the storeroom and yanked down on the drawstring of the overhead light. The closet was filled, floor to ceiling, with canvases and sketches. Gabriel began leafing through the work. He'd forgotten how gifted his mother was. He could see the influence of Beckmann, Picasso, Egon Schiele, and, of course, her father, Viktor Frankl. There were even variations on themes Gabriel had been exploring in his own work at the time. His mother had expanded on them, or, in some cases, utterly demolished them. She had been breathtakingly talented. Ziona pushed him aside and came out with a stack of canvases and two large envelopes filled with sketches. Gabriel crouched on the stone floor and examined the works while Ziona looked on over his shoulder. There were images of the camps, children crowded into bunks, women slaving over machinery in the factories, bodies stacked like cordwood, waiting to be hurled into the fire, a family huddled together while the gas gathered round them. The final canvas depicted a solitary figure, an SS man dressed head to toe in black. It was the painting he had seen that day in his mother's studio. While the other works were dark and abstract, here she strove for realism and revelation. Gabriel found himself marveling at her impeccable draftsmanship and brushwork, before his eyes finally settled on the face of the subject. It belonged to Erich Radek. Siona made a bed for Gabriel on the living room couch and told him the midrash of the broken vessel.
"Before God created the world, there was only God. When God decided to create the world, God pulled back in order to create a space for the world. It was in that space that the universe was formed. But now, in that space, there was no God. God created divine sparks, light, to be placed back into God's creation. When God created light and placed light inside of creation, special containers were prepared to hold it. But there was an accident, a cosmic accident. The containers broke. The universe became filled with sparks of God's divine light and shards of broken containers."
"It's a lovely story," Gabriel said, helping Siona tuck the end of a sheet beneath the couch cushions.
"But what does it have to do with my mother?" "The Midrash teaches us that until the sparks of God's light are gathered together, the task of creation will not be complete. As Jews, this is our solemn duty. We call it Tikkun Olam, repair of the world."
"I can restore many things, Ziona, but I'm afraid the world is too broad a canvas, with far too much damage."
"So start small."
"How?"
"Gather your mother's sparks, Gabriel, and punish the man who broke her vessel."
The following morning, Gabriel slipped out of Siona's apartment without waking her, and crept down the cobblestone steps in the shadowless grey light of dawn, with the portrait of Radek beneath his arm. An Orthodox Jew on his way to morning prayer thought him a madman and shook his fist in anger. Gabriel loaded the painting into the trunk of the car and headed out of Safed. A blood-red sunrise broke over the ridge. Below, on the valley floor, the Sea of Galilee turned to fire. He stopped in Afula for breakfast, and left a message on Moshe Rivlin's voicemail, warning him that he was coming back to Yad Vashem. It was late morning by the time he arrived. Rivlin was waiting for him. Gabriel showed him the canvas.
"Who painted it?"
"My mother."
"What was her name?"
"Irena Allon, but her German name was Frankl."
"Where was she?"
"The women's camp at Birkenau, from January 1943 until the end."
"The death march?"
Gabriel nodded. Rivlin seized Gabriel by the arm and said,
"Come with me."
Rivlin placed Gabriel at a table in the main reading room of the archives and sat down before a computer terminal. He entered the words Irena Allon into the database, and drummed his stubby fingers impatiently on the keyboard while waiting for a response. A few seconds later, he scribbled 5 numbers onto a piece of scratch paper, and without a word to Gabriel disappeared through a doorway leading to the storerooms of the archives. 20 minutes later, he returned and placed a document on the table. Behind a clear plastic cover were the words Yad Vashem Archives, in both Hebrew and English, along with a file number, 03/812. Gabriel carefully lifted the plastic cover and turned to the first page. The Testimony of Irena Allon, delivered March 19, 1957. Rivlin placed a hand on his shoulder and slipped out of the room. Gabriel hesitated a moment, then looked down and began to read. Chapter 16. The Testimony of Irena Allon, March 19, 1957. I will not tell all the things I saw. I cannot. I owe this much to the dead. I will not tell you all the unspeakable cruelty we endured at the hands of the so-called master race, nor will I tell you the things that some of us did in order to survive just one more day. Only those who lived through it will ever understand what it was truly like, and I will not humiliate the dead one last time. I will only tell you the things that I did, and the things that were done to me. I spent 2 years in Auschwitz-Birkenau, 2 years to the very day, almost precisely 2 years. My name is Irena Allon. I used to be called Irena Frankel. This is what I witnessed in January 1945 on the death march from Birkenau. To understand the misery of the death march, you must first know something of what came before. You've heard the story from others. Mine is not so different. Like all the others, we came by train. Ours set out from Berlin in the middle of the night. They told us we were going to the east, to work. We believed them. They told us it would be a proper carriage with seats. They assured us we would be given food and water. We believed them. My father, the painter, Viktor Frankl, had packed a sketchpad and some pencils. He had been fired from his teaching position, and his work had been declared degenerate by the Nazis. Most of his paintings had been seized and burned. He hoped the Nazis would allow him to resume his work in the East. Of course, it was not a proper carriage with seats, and there was no food or water. I do not remember precisely how long the journey lasted. I lost count of how many times the sun rose and set, how many times we travelled in and out of the darkness. There was no toilet, only one bucket. One bucket for 60 of us. You can imagine the conditions we endured. You can imagine the unbearable smell. You can imagine the things some of us resorted to when our thirst pushed us over the edge of insanity. On the second day, an old woman standing next to me died. I closed her eyes and prayed for her. I watched my mother, Hannah Frankel, and waited for her to die too. Nearly half our car was dead by the time the train finally screeched to a stop. Some prayed. Some actually thanked God the journey was finally over. For 10 years, we had lived under Hitler's thumb. We had suffered the Nuremberg laws. We had lived the nightmare of Kristallnacht. We had watched our synagogues burn. Even so, I was not prepared for the sight that greeted me when the bolts slid back and the doors were finally thrown open. I saw a towering, tapered red brick chimney, belching thick smoke. Below the chimney was a building, aglow with a raging, leaping flame. There was a terrible smell on the air. We could not identify it. It lingers in my nostrils to this day. There was a sign over the rail platform, Auschwitz. I knew then that I had arrived in hell. Juden, raus, raus! An SS man cracks a whip across my thigh.
"Get out of the car, Juden!"
I jump onto the snow-covered platform. My legs, weak from many days of standing, buckle beneath me. The SS man cracks his whip again, this time across my shoulders. The pain is like nothing I have ever felt before. I get to my feet. Somehow, I manage not to cry out. I try to help my mother down from the car. The SS man pushes me away. My father jumps onto the platform and collapses. My mother, too. Like me, they are whipped to their feet. Men in striped pajamas clamber onto the train and start tossing out our luggage. I think, who are these crazy people trying to steal the meager possessions they had permitted us to bring? They look like men from an insane asylum, shaved heads, sunken faces, rotten teeth. My father turns to an SS officer and says, "Look, there, those people are taking our things. Stop them." The SS officer calmly replies that our luggage is not being stolen, just removed for sorting. It would be sent along, once we'd been assigned housing. My father thanks the SS man. With clubs and whips, they separate us, men from women, and instruct us to form neat rows of five. I did not know it then, but I will spend much of the next 2 years standing or marching in neat rows of five. I am able to maneuver myself next to my mother. I try to hold her hand. An SS man brings his club down on my arm, severing my grasp. I hear music. Somewhere, a chamber orchestra is playing Schubert. At the head of the line is a table and a few SS officers. One in particular stands out. He has black hair and skin the color of alabaster. He wears a pleasant smile on his handsome face. His uniform is neatly pressed. His riding boots shine in the bright lights of the rail platform. Kid gloves cover his hands, spotless and white. He is whistling the Blue Danube Waltz. To this day, I cannot bear to hear it. Later, I will learn his name. His name is Mengele, the chief doctor of Auschwitz. It is Mengele who decides who is capable of work and who will go immediately to the gas. Right and left, life and death. My father steps forward. Mengele, whistling, glances at him, then says pleasantly, "To the left, please." "I was assured I would be going to a family camp," my father says. "Will my wife be coming with me?" "Is that what you wish?" "Yes, of course. Which one is your wife?" My father points to my mother. Mengele says, "You there, get out of line and join your husband on the left. Hurry, please, we haven't got all night." I watch my parents walk away to the left, following the others. Old people and small children, that's who goes to the left. Young and healthy are being sent to the right. I step forward to face the beautiful man in his spotless uniform. He looks me up and down, seems pleased, and wordlessly points to the right. "But my parents went to the left." The devil smiles. There is a gap between his two front teeth. "You'll be with them soon enough, but trust me, for now, it's better you go to the right." He seems so kind, so pleasant. I believe him. I go to the right. I look over my shoulder for my parents, but they have been swallowed by the mass of filthy, exhausted humanity, trudging quietly toward the gas, in neat rows of five. I cannot possibly tell you everything that took place during the next 2 years. Some of it I cannot remember. Some of it I have chosen to forget. There was a merciless rhythm to Birkenau, a monotonous cruelty that ran on a tight and efficient schedule. Death was constant, yet even death became monotonous. We are shorn, not just our heads, but everywhere, our arms,
our legs, even our pubic hair. They don't seem to care that the shears are cutting our skin. They don't seem to hear our screams. We are assigned a number and tattooed on our left arm just below the elbow. I cease to be Irene Frankel. Now I am a tool of the Reich, known as 29395. They spray us with disinfectant. They give us prison clothing made from heavy, rough wool. Mine smells of sweat and blood. I try not to breathe too deeply. Our shoes are wooden blocks with leather straps. We cannot walk in them. Who could? We are given a metal bowl and are ordered to carry it at all times. Should we misplace our bowl, we are told we will be shot immediately. We believe them. We are taken to a barracks not fit for animals. The women who await us are something less than human. They are starving. Their stares are vacant. Their movements slow and listless. I wonder how long it will be before I look like them. One of these half-humans points me toward an empty bunk. 5 girls crowd onto a wooden shelf with only a bit of bug-infested straw for bedding. We introduce ourselves. 2 are sisters, Rosa and Regina. The others are called Leni and Rachel. We are all German. We have all lost our parents on the selection ramp. We form a new family that night. We hold each other and pray. None of us sleeps. We are awakened at 4 o'clock the next morning. I will wake at 4 o'clock every morning for the next 2 years, except on those nights when they order a special nighttime roll call and make us stand at attention in the freezing yard for hours on end. We are divided into commandos and sent out to work. Most days, we march out into the surrounding countryside to shovel and sift sand for construction, or to work in the camp agricultural projects. Some days we build roads or move stone from place to place. Not a single day passes that I am not beaten. A blow with a club, a whip across my back, a kick in the ribs. The offense can be dropping a stone or resting too long on the handle of my shovel. The 2 winters are bitterly cold. They give us no extra clothing to protect us from the weather, even when we are working outside. The summers are miserably hot. We all contract malaria. The mosquitoes do not discriminate between German masters and Jewish slaves. Even Mengele comes down with malaria. They do not give us enough food to survive, only enough so that we would starve slowly and still be of service to the Reich. I lose my period, then I lose my breasts. Before long, I too look like one of the half-humans I'd seen that first day in Birkenau. For breakfast, it's grey water they call tea. For lunch, rancid soup, which we eat in the place where we are working. Sometimes there might be a small morsel of meat. Some of the girls refuse to eat it because it is not kosher. I do not abide by the dietary laws while I am at Auschwitz-Birkenau. There is no God in the death camps, and I hate God for abandoning us to our fate. If there is meat in my bowl, I eat it. For supper we are given bread. It is mostly sawdust. We learn to eat half the bread at night and save the rest for the morning so that we have something in our stomachs before we march to the fields to work. If you collapse at work, they beat you. If you cannot get up, they toss you onto the back of a flatbed and carry you to the gas. This is our life in the women's camp of Birkenau. We wake. We remove the dead from their bunks, the lucky ones who perish peacefully in their sleep. We drink our grey tea. We go to roll call. We march out to work in neat rows of 5. We eat our lunch. We are beaten. We come back to camp. We go to roll call. We eat our bread. We sleep and wait for it all to begin again. They make us work on Shabbat, On Sundays, their holy day, there is no work. Every third Sunday they shave us. Everything runs on a schedule. Everything except the selections. We learn to anticipate them. Like animals, our survival senses are highly tuned. The camp population is the most reliable warning sign. When the camp is too full, there will be a selection. There is never a warning. After roll call, we are ordered to line up on the Lagerstrasse to await our turn before Mengele and his selection team, to await our chance to prove we are still capable of work, still worthy of life. The selections take an entire day. They give us no food and nothing to drink. Some never make it to the table, where Mengele plays God. They are selected by the SS sadists long before. A brute named Tauber enjoys making us do exercises while we wait, so we will be strong for the selectors. He forces us to do push-ups, then orders us to put our faces in the mud and stay there. Tauber has a special punishment for any girl who moves. He steps on her head with all his weight and crushes her skull. Finally, we stand before our judge. He looks us up and down, takes note of our number. Open your mouth, Jew. Lift your arms. We try to look after our health in this cesspool, but it is impossible. A sore throat can mean a trip to the gas. Salves and ointments are too precious to waste on Jews, so a cut on the hand can mean the gas the next time Mengele is culling the population. If we pass visual inspection, our judge has one final test. He points toward a ditch and says, "Jump, Jew." I stand before the ditch and gather my last reserves of strength. Land on the other side, and I will live, at least until the next selection. Fall in, and I will be tossed onto the back of a flatbed and driven to the gas. The first time I go through this madness, I think, I am a German Jewish girl from Berlin, from a good family. My father was a renowned painter. Why am I jumping this trench? After that, I think of nothing but reaching the other side and landing on my feet. Rosa is the first of our new family to be selected. She has the misfortune of being very sick with malaria at the time of a big selection, and there is no way to conceal it from Mengele's expert eyes. Regina begs the devil to take her too, so that her sister will not have to die alone in the gas. Mengele smiles, revealing his gapped teeth. "You'll go soon enough, but you can work a little longer first. Go to the right. For the only time in my life, I am glad not to have a sister." Regina stops eating. She doesn't seem to notice when they beat her at work. She has crossed over the line. She is already dead. At the next big selection, she waits patiently on the endless line. She endures Tauber's exercises and keeps her face in the mud so he will not crush her skull. When finally she reaches the selection table, she flies at Mengele and tries to stab him through the eye with the handle of her spoon. An SS man shoots her in the stomach. Mengele is clearly frightened. "Don't waste any gas on her. Throw her into the fire alive. Up the chimney with her." They toss Regina into a wheelbarrow. We watch her go and pray she dies before she reaches the crematorium. In the autumn of 1944, we begin hearing the Russian guns. In September, the camp's air raid sirens sound for the first time. 3 weeks later, they sound again, and the camp's anti-aircraft guns fire their first shots. That same day, the Sonderkommando at Crematorium 4 revolt. They attack their SS guards with pickaxes and hammers and manage to set fire to their barracks and the crematoria
before being machine-gunned. A week later, bombs fall into the camp itself. Our masters show signs of stress. They no longer look so invincible. Sometimes they even look a little frightened. This gives us a certain pleasure and a modicum of hope. The gassings stop. They still kill us, but they have to do it themselves. Selected prisoners are shot in the gas chambers or near Crematorium 5. Soon they begin dismantling the crematoria. Our hope of survival increases. The situation deteriorates throughout that autumn and winter. Food is in short supply. Each day many women collapse and die of starvation and exhaustion. Typhus takes a terrible toll. In December, Allied bombs fall on the IG Farben synthetic fuel and rubber plant. A few days later, the Allies strike again, but this time several bombs fall on an SS sickbay barracks inside Birkenau. 5 SS are killed. The guards grow more irritable, more unpredictable. I avoid them. I try to make myself invisible. The new year comes. 1944 turns to 1945. We can sense Auschwitz is dying. We pray it will be soon. We debate what to do. Should we wait for the Russians to free us? Should we try to escape? And if we manage to get across the wire, where will we go? The Polish peasants hate us just as much as the Germans. We wait. What else can we do? In mid-January, I smell smoke. I look out the barracks door. Bonfires are raging all over the camps. The smell is different. For the first time, they're not burning people. They're burning paper. They're burning the evidence of their crimes. The ash drifts over Birkenau like snowfall. I smile for the first time in 2 years. On January 17th, Mengele leaves. The end is near. Shortly after midnight, there is a roll call. We are told the entire Auschwitz camp is being evacuated. The Reich still requires our bodies. The healthy will evacuate on foot. The sick will stay behind to meet their fate. We fall into rank and march out in neat rows of 5. At 1 o'clock in the morning, I pass through the gates of hell for the last time. 2 years to the day after my arrival, almost 2 years to the hour. I am not free yet. I have one more test to endure. The snowfall is heavy and relentless. In the distance we can hear the thunder of an artillery duel. We walk, a seemingly endless chain of half-humans, dressed in our striped rags and our clogs. The shooting is as relentless as the snow. We try to count the shots. 100, 200, 3, 4, 5. We stop counting after that. Each shot represents one more life extinguished, one more murder. We number several thousand when we set out. I fear we will all be dead before we reach our destination. Leni walks on my left, Rachel on my right. We dare not stumble. Those who stumble are shot on the spot and thrown into a ditch. We dare not fall out of formation and lag behind. Those who do are shot too. The road is littered with the dead. We step over them and pray we do not falter. We eat snow to quench our thirst. There is nothing we can do about the horrible cold. A woman takes pity on us and throws boiled potatoes. Those foolish enough to pick them up are shot dead. We sleep in barns or in abandoned barracks. Those who cannot rise quickly enough when awakened are shot dead. My hunger seems to be eating a hole in my stomach. It is much worse than the hunger of Birkenau. Somehow, I summon the strength to keep placing one foot in front of the other. Yes, I want to survive.
But it is also a matter of defiance. They want me to fall, so they can shoot me. I want to witness the destruction of their thousand-year Reich. I want to rejoice in its death, just as the Germans rejoiced in ours. I think of Regina flying at Mengele during the selection, trying to kill him with her spoon. Regina's courage gives me strength. Each step is rebellion. On the third day, at nightfall, he comes for me. He is on horseback. We are sitting in the snow at the side of the road, resting. Leni is leaning on me. Her eyes are closed. I fear she is finished. Rachel presses snow to her lips to revive her. Rachel is the strongest. She had practically carried Leni all that afternoon. He looks at me. He is a Sturmbahnführer in the SS. After 12 years of living under the Nazis, I have learned to recognize their insignia. I try to make myself invisible. I turn my head and tend to Leni. He yanks on the reins of his horse and maneuvers himself into position so he can look at me some more. I wonder what he sees in me. Yes, I was a pretty girl once, but I am hideous now, exhausted, filthy, sick, a walking skeleton. I cannot bear my own smell. I know that if I interact with him, it will end badly. I put my head on my knees and feign sleep. He is too smart for that. "You there!" he calls. I look up. The man on horseback is pointing directly at me. "Yes, you, get on your feet. Come with me." I stand up. I am dead. I know it. Rachel knows it too. I can see it in her eyes. She has no more tears to cry. "Remember me," I whisper, as I follow the man on horseback into the trees. Thankfully, he does not ask me to walk far. Just a spot a few meters from the side of the road, where a large tree had fallen. He dismounts and tethers his horse. He sits down on the fallen tree and orders me to sit next to him. I hesitate. No SS man has ever asked such a thing. He pats the tree with the palm of his hand. I sit, but several inches farther away than he had commanded. I am afraid, but I am also humiliated by my smell. He slides closer. He stinks of alcohol. I'm done for. It's only a question of time. I look straight ahead. He removes his gloves, then touches my face. In 2 years, at Birkenau, no SS man had ever touched me. Why is this man, a Sturmbahnführer, touching me now? I have endured many torments, but this is by far the worst. I look straight ahead. My flesh is ablaze. "Such a shame," he says. "Were you very beautiful once?" I can think of nothing to say. 2 years at Birkenau has taught me that in situations like these, there is never a right answer. If I answer yes, he'll accuse me of Jewish arrogance and kill me. If I answer no, he'll kill me for lying. "I'll share a secret with you. I've always been attracted to Jewesses. If you ask me, we should have killed the men and utilized the women for our own enjoyment. Did you have a child? I think of all the children I saw going to the gas at Birkenau." He demands a response by squeezing my face between his thumb and fingers. I close my eyes and try not to cry out. He repeats the question. I shake my head and he releases his grip. "If you're able to survive the next few hours, you might someday have a child. Will you tell this child about what happened to you during the war? Or will you be too ashamed?" "A child? How could a girl in my position ever contemplate giving birth to a child? I have spent the last 2 years simply trying to survive. A child is beyond my comprehension. Answer me, Jew! His voice is suddenly harsh. I feel the situation is about to spin out of control. He takes hold of my face again and turns it toward him. I try to look away, but he shakes me, compelling me to look into his eyes. I have no strength to resist. His face is instantly chiseled into my memory. So is the sound of his voice and his Austrian-accented German. I hear it still. What will you tell your child about the war? What does he want to hear? What does he want me to say? He squeezes my face. Speak, Jew. What will you tell your child about the war? The truth, Herr Sturmbahnführer. I'll tell my child the truth. Where these words come from, I do not know. I only know that if I am to die, I will die with a modicum of dignity. I think again of Regina flying at Mengele, armed with a spoon. He relaxes his grip. The first crisis seems to have passed. He exhales heavily, as if exhausted by his long day of work, then removes a flask from the pocket of his greatcoat and takes a long pull. Thankfully, he does not offer me any. He returns the flask to his pocket and lights a cigarette. He does not offer me a cigarette. I have tobacco and liquor, he is telling me. You have nothing. The truth? What is the truth, Jew, as you see it? Birkenau is the truth, Herr Sturmbahnführer. No, my dear, Birkenau is not the truth. Birkenau is a rumor. Birkenau is an invention by enemies of the Reich and Christianity. It is Stalinist atheist propaganda. What about the gas chambers, the crematoria? These things did not exist at Birkenau. I saw them, Herr Sturmbahnführer. We all saw them. No one is going to believe such a thing. No one is going to believe it's possible to kill so many thousands. Surely the death of thousands is possible. After all, this was war. Hundreds of thousands? Perhaps. But millions? He draws on his cigarette. To tell you the truth, I saw it with my own eyes, and even I cannot believe it. A shot crackles through the forest. Then another. Two more girls gone. The Sturmbahnführer takes another long pull at his flask of liquor. Why is he drinking? Is he trying to keep warm? Or is he stealing himself before he kills me? I'm going to tell you what you're going to say about the war. You're going to say that you were transferred to the East, that you had work, that you had plenty of food and proper medical care, that we treated you well and humanely. If that is the truth, Herr Sturmbahnführer, then why am I a skeleton? He has no answer, except to draw his pistol and place it against my temple. Recite to me what happened to you during the war, Jew. You were transferred to the East. You had plenty of food and proper medical care. The gas chambers and the crematoria are Bolshevik Jewish inventions. Say those words, Jew. I know there is no escaping this situation with my life. Even if I say the words, I am dead. I will not say them. I will not give him the satisfaction. I close my eyes and wait for his bullet to carve a tunnel through my brain and release me from my torment. He lowers the gun and calls out. Another SS man comes running. The Sturmbahnführer orders him to stand guard over me. He leaves and walks back through the trees to the road.
When he returns, he is accompanied by two women. One is Rachel. The other is Lenny. He orders the SS man to leave, then places the gun to Lenny's forehead. Lenny looks directly into my eyes. Her life is in my hands.
Say the words, Jew. You were transferred to the East. You had plenty of food and proper medical care. The gas chambers and the crematoria are Bolshevik Jewish lies.
I cannot allow Lenny to be killed by my silence. I open my mouth to speak, but before I can recite the words, Rachel shouts, "Don't say it, Irina! He's going to kill us anyway! Don't give him the pleasure!" The Sturmbannführer removes the gun from Lenny's head and places it against Rachel's.
"You say it, Jewish bitch!"
Rachel looks him directly in the eye and remains silent. The Sturmbannführer pulls his trigger, and Rachel falls dead into the snow. He places the gun against Lenny's head, and once again commands me to speak. Lenny slowly shakes her head. We say goodbye with our eyes. Another shot, and Lenny falls next to Rachel. It is my turn to die. The Sturmbannführer points the gun at me. From the road comes the sound of shouting.
"Raus! Raus!"
The SS are prodding the girls to their feet. I know my walk is over. I know I am not leaving this place with my life. This is where I will fall, at the side of a Polish road, and here I will be buried, with no mazavot to mark my grave.
What will you tell your child about the war, Jew?
The truth, Herr Sturmbannführer. I'll tell my child the truth.
No one will believe you.
He holsters his pistol.
Your column is leaving.
You should join them. You know what happens to those who fall behind. He mounts his horse and jerks on the reins. I collapse in the snow next to the bodies of my two friends. I pray for them and beg their forgiveness. The end of the column passes by. I stagger out of the trees and fall into place. We walk that entire night in neat rows of five. I shed tears of ice. 5 days after walking out of Birkenau, we come to a train station in the Silesian village of Wodzislaw. We are herded onto open coal cars and travel through the night, exposed to the vicious January weather. The Germans had no need to waste any more of their precious ammunition on us. The cold kills half of the girls on my car alone. We arrive at a new camp, Ravensburg, but there is not enough food for the new prisoners. After a few days, some of us move on, this time by flatbed truck. I end my odyssey in a camp in Neustadt, Glewe. On May 2, 1945, we wake to discover that our SS tormentors have fled the camp. Later that day, we are liberated by American and Russian soldiers. It has been 12 years. Not a day passes that I don't see the faces of Rachel and Lenny, and the face of the man who murdered them. Their deaths weigh heavily upon me. Had I recited the Sturmbannführer's words, perhaps they would be alive, and I would be lying in an unmarked grave next to a Polish road, just another nameless victim. On the anniversary of their murders, I say Mourner's Kaddish for them. I do this out of habit, but not faith. I lost my faith in God in Birkenau. My name is Irene Allon. I used to be called Irene Frankel. In the camp, I was known as prisoner number 29395, and this is what I witnessed in January 1945 on the death march from Birkenau. Chapter 17. Tiberias, Israel. It was Shabbat. Shamron ordered Gabriel to come to Tiberias for supper. As Gabriel drove slowly along the steeply sloped drive, he looked up at Shamron's terrace and saw gaslights dancing in the wind from the lake. And then he glimpsed Shamron, the eternal sentinel, pacing slowly amid the flames. Gila, before serving them food, lit a pair of candles in the dining room and recited the blessing. Gabriel had been raised in a home without religion, but at that moment he thought the sight of Shamron's wife, her eyes closed, her hands drawing the candlelight toward her face, was the most beautiful he'd ever seen. Shamron was withdrawn and preoccupied during the meal, and in no mood for small talk. Even now he would not speak of his work in front of Gila, not because he didn't trust her, but because he feared she would stop loving him if she knew all the things he had done. Gila filled the long silences by talking about her daughter, who'd moved to New Zealand to get away from her father, and was living with a man on a chicken farm. She knew Gabriel was somehow linked to the office, but suspected nothing of the true nature of his work. She thought him a clerk of some sort who spent a great deal of time abroad and enjoyed art. She served them coffee and a tray of cookies and dried fruit, then cleared the table and saw to the dishes. Gabriel, over the sound of running water and clinking china emanating from the kitchen, brought Shamron up to date. They spoke in low voices, with the Shabbat candles flickering between them. Gabriel showed him the files on Erich Radek and Aktion 1005. Shamron held the photograph up to the candlelight and squinted, then pushed his reading glasses onto his bald head and settled his hard gaze on Gabriel once more. "How much do you know about what happened to my mother during the war?" Shamron's calculated look, delivered over the rim of a coffee cup, made it plain there was nothing he did not know about Gabriel's life, including what had happened to his mother during the war.
"She was from Berlin," Shamron said. "She was deported to Auschwitz in January 1943 and spent 2 years in the women's camp at Birkenau. She left Birkenau on a death march. Unlike thousands of others, she managed to survive and was liberated by Russian and American troops at Neustadt Glewa. Am I forgetting anything?"
"Something happened to her on the death march. Something she would never discuss with me." Gabriel held up the photograph of Erich Radek. "When Rivlin showed me this at Yad Vashem, I knew I'd seen the face somewhere before. It took me a while to remember, but finally I did. I saw it when I was a boy, on canvases in my mother's studio."
"Which is why you went to Safed, to see Tzion Levin."
"How do you know?" Shamron sighed and sipped his coffee. Gabriel, unnerved, told Shamron about his second visit to Yad Vashem that morning. When he placed the pages of his mother's testimony on the table, Shamron's eyes remained fixed on Gabriel's face. And then Gabriel realized that Shamron had read it before. The Memune knew about his mother. The Memune knew everything.
"You were being considered for one of the most important assignments in the history of the office," Shamron said. His voice contained no trace of remorse. "I needed to know everything I could about you. Your army psychological profile described you as a lone wolf, egotistical, with the emotional coldness of a natural killer. My first visit with you provided confirmation of this, though I also found you unbearably rude and clinically shy. I wanted to know why you were the way you were. I thought your mother might be a good place to start."
"So you looked up her testimony at Yad Vashem?" He closed his eyes and nodded once. "Why didn't you ever say anything to me?"
"It wasn't my place," Shamron said without sentiment. "Only your mother could tell you about such a thing. She obviously carried a terrible burden of guilt until the day she died. She didn't want you to know. She wasn't alone. There were many survivors, just like your mother, who could never bring themselves to truly confront their memories. In the years after the war, before you were born, It seemed as though a wall of silence had been erected in this country. The Holocaust. It was discussed endlessly, but those who actually endured it tried desperately to bury their memories and move on. It was another form of survival. Unfortunately, their pain was passed on to the next generation, the sons and daughters of the survivors. People like Gabriel Allon.
Shamron was interrupted by Gila, who poked her head into the room and asked whether they needed more coffee. Shamron held up his hand. Gila understood they were discussing work and slipped back into the kitchen. Shamron folded his arms on the table and leaned forward.
Surely you must have suspected she'd given testimony. Why didn't that natural curiosity of yours lead you to Yad Vashem, to have a look for yourself?
Shamron, greeted only by Gabriel's silence, answered the question for himself.
Because, like all children of survivors, you were always careful not to disturb your mother's fragile emotional state. You were afraid that if you pushed too hard, you might send her into a depression from which she might never return?
He paused.
Or was it because you feared what you might find? Were you actually afraid to know the truth?
Gabriel looked up sharply but made no reply. Shamron contemplated his coffee for a moment before speaking again.
To be honest with you, Gabriel, when I read your mother's testimony, I knew that you were perfect. You work for me because of her. She was incapable of loving you completely. How could she? She was afraid she would lose you. Everyone she'd ever loved had been taken from her. She lost her parents on the selection ramp, and the girls she befriended at Birkenau were taken from her because she would not say the words an SS Sturmbannfuhrer wanted her to say. I would have understood if she tried to tell me.
Shamron slowly shook his head.
No, Gabriel, no one can truly understand the guilt, the shame. Your mother managed to find her way in this world after the war, but in many ways her life ended that night on the side of a Polish road.
He brought his palm down on the table hard enough to rattle the remaining dishes.
So what do we do? Do we wallow in self-pity? Or do we keep working and see if this man is truly Erich Radek?
I think you know the answer to that.
Does Moshe Rivlin think it's possible Radek was involved in the evacuation of Auschwitz?
Gabriel nodded. By January 1945, the work of Aktion 1005 was largely complete, since all of the conquered territory in the east had been overrun by the Soviets. It's possible he went to Auschwitz to demolish the gas chambers and crematoria and prepare the remaining prisoners for evacuation. They were, after all, witnesses to the crime.
Do we know how this piece of filth managed to get out of Europe after the war?
Gabriel told him Rivlin's theory, that Radek, because he was an Austrian Catholic, had availed himself of the services of Bishop Alois Hudal in Rome.
So why don't we follow the trail?
Shamron said. And see if it leads back to Austria again.
My thoughts exactly. I thought I'd start in Rome. I want to have a look at Hudal's papers.
So would a lot of other people.
But they don't have the private number of the man who lives on the top floor of the Apostolic Palace.
Shamron shrugged.
This is true.
I need a clean passport.
Not a problem. I have a very good Canadian passport you can use.
How's your French these days?
Pas mal, mais je dois pratiquer l'accent d'un Québécois.
Sometimes you frighten even me.
That's saying something. You'll spend the night here and leave for Rome tomorrow.
I'll take you to Lod. On the way we'll stop at the American Embassy and have a chat with the local head of station.
About what?
According to the file from the Staatsarchiv, Vogel worked for the Americans in Austria during the occupation period. I've asked our friends in Langley to have a look through their files and see if Vogel's name pops up. It's a long shot, but maybe we'll get lucky.
Gabriel looked down at his mother's testimony.
I will not tell all the things I saw. I cannot. I owe this much to the dead.
Your mother was a very brave woman, Gabriel. That's why I chose you. I knew you came from excellent stock.
She was much braver than I am.
Yes, Shamron agreed. She was braver than all of us.
Bruce Crawford's real occupation was one of the worst-kept secrets in Israel. The tall patrician American was the chief of the CIA's Tel Aviv station. Declared to both the Israeli government and the Palestinian Authority, he often served as a conduit between the two warring sides. Seldom was the night Crawford's telephone didn't ring at some hideous hour. He was tired and looked it. He greeted Shamron just inside the gates of the embassy on Haraikon Street and escorted him into the building. Crawford's office was large and, for Shamron's taste, over-decorated. It seemed the office of a corporate vice president, rather than the lair of a spy, but then that was the American way. Shamron sank into a leather chair and accepted a glass of chilled water with lemon from a secretary. He considered lighting a Turkish cigarette, then noticed the no-smoking sign prominently displayed on the front of Crawford's desk. Crawford seemed in no hurry to get down to the matter at hand. Shamron had expected this. There was an unwritten rule among spies. When one asks a friend for a favor, one must be prepared to sing for his supper. Shamron, because he was technically out of the game, could offer nothing tangible, only the advice and wisdom of a man who had made many mistakes. Finally, after an hour, Crawford said, "About that Vogel thing." The American's voice trailed off. Shamron, taking note of the tinge of failure in Crawford's voice, leaned forward in his chair expectantly. Crawford played for time by removing a paperclip from his special magnetic dispenser and industriously straightening it. "We had a look through our own files," Crawford said, his gaze downward at his work. "We even sent a team out to Maryland to dig through the archives annex. I'm afraid we struck out."
Struck out?
Shamron considered the use of American sports colloquialisms inappropriate for a business so vital as espionage. Agents in Shamron's world did not strike out, fumble the ball, or make slam dunks. There was only success or failure, and the price of failure, in a neighborhood like the Middle East, was usually blood.
"What does this mean, exactly?"
"It means," Crawford said pedantically, "that our search produced nothing. I'm sorry, Ari, but sometimes that's the way it goes with these things." He held up his straightened paperclip and examined it carefully, as though proud of his accomplishment. Gabriel was waiting in the back seat of Shamron's Peugeot. "How did it go?" Shamron lit a cigarette and answered the question.
"Do you believe him?" "You know, if he told me that they'd found a routine personnel file or a security clearance background report, I might have believed him. But nothing? Who does he think he's talking to? I'm insulted, Gabriel. I truly am."
"You think the Americans know something about Vogel?"
"Bruce Crawford just confirmed it for us."
Shamron glared at his stainless steel watch.
"Then it took him an hour to screw up the nerve to lie to me, and now you're going to miss your flight."
Gabriel looked down at the telephone in the console.
"Do it," he murmured. "I dare you."
Shamron snatched up the telephone and dialed.
"This is Shamron," he snapped. "There's an El Al flight leaving Lod for Rome in 30 minutes. It has just developed a mechanical problem that will require a 1-hour delay in its departure. Understand?"
2 hours later, Bruce Crawford's telephone purred. He brought the receiver to his ear. He recognized the voice. It was the surveillance man he had assigned to follow Shamron. A dangerous game, following the former chief of the office on his own soil, but Crawford was under orders. After he left the embassy, he went to Lod.
What was he doing at the airport?
Dropping off a passenger.
Did you recognize him?
The surveillance man indicated that he did. Without mentioning the passenger's name, he managed to communicate the fact that the man in question was a noteworthy office agent, recently active in a central European city.
"Are you sure it was him?"
"No doubt about it."
"Where was he going?"
Crawford, after hearing the answer, severed the connection. A moment later he was seated before his computer, punching out a secure cable to headquarters. The text was direct and terse, just the way the addressee liked it. Elijah is heading to Rome. Arrives tonight on El Al flight from Tel Aviv.
End of Disc 4.